Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents Judgment Ridge, The True Story Behind the Dartmouth Murders, by Dick Lair and Mitchell Zuckoff, narrated by Danny Campbell. Part 1. A Stranger at the Door. At just past 10 on a cool summer night, Andrew Patty nestled with his 11-year-old son on a warm blue sofa in the living room of their Vermont vacation home. Burning logs hissed and popped in the red brick fireplace as Patty read aloud to Andy Jr. from an adventure story about a hunter pursuing a wise and elusive buck. Bam, 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 bam! A staccato burst of pounding on the front door interrupted him in mid-sentence. Startled, Patty rose to his feet, silently motioning to Andy to stay put. It was too late for visitors, and the knocks were too sharp, too insistent to come from the hand of a friend. Someone must be in trouble, or looking for trouble. As Patty stood, he reached under the untucked hem of his work shirt for the 9mm Glock pistol he always wore on his right hip. With a quick flip of his thumb, he unsnapped the safety latch and slid the matte black gun from its leather holster. Patty walked slowly to the door, holding the Glock out of sight, tucked close against the right rear pocket of his faded jeans. With his empty left hand, he pushed aside the blind covering the 9 small windows on the upper half of the door. On his front porch stood a young man Patty had never seen before. He was about 6 feet tall, lanky, dressed in a white T-shirt, black cargo pants, and black military boots. The young man, maybe in his late teens, Patty thought, leaned in close, his hot breath leaving vapor clouds on the glass. His hands were half-clenched like bear claws, his eyes wide and intense. The weak rays of a bug-yellow porch light cast a sticky glare on his pale skin. "What's up?" Patty asked roughly. "I have car trouble. Can you help me out?" The stranger answered just as roughly. They stood for a moment face to face, inches apart, separated by only a pane of glass, each waiting to see what the other would do. Andrew Patty was 47, a trim, good-looking man of medium height, with thick, dark hair flecked with gray. He was a lifelong New Yorker, with the accent and toothpick-chewing habit to prove it. Though raised in a cookie-cutter suburb of tract houses and strip malls, as a teenager Patty had grown enchanted by the mountains and forests of Vermont. As his only child and namesake approached manhood, Patty wanted Andy to know the embrace of untamed woods, the snap of a fish latching onto a hook, the smell of fresh-cut trees, the ping of a tin can pierced by a well-aimed bullet. Patty and his wife Diane, also 47 and a native New Yorker, lived and worked on Long Island, running an agency that provided services for infants and toddlers with special needs. It was successful enough to allow them to purchase their getaway home in the town of Verscher on the eastern side of Vermont, halfway between Massachusetts and Canada. Verscher's name was an amalgam of Vermont and New Hampshire, owing to the abundance of hills offering views from the former to the latter, some 15 miles away across the Connecticut River. One of the hills was called Judgment Ridge, named for a defunct ski area once located there. Judgment Ridge was less than a mile from the Patty's house, just off the main road that connected the neighboring town of Chelsea to Interstate 91. Once on the interstate, it was a short drive south to Hanover, New Hampshire, home of Dartmouth College, and from there to the world beyond. Verscher was best known to outsiders as home to the Mountain School, a private school that doubled as a working farm, allowing high school students to combine traditional studies with lessons on sustainable rural living. Verscher also was a magnet for second homeowners like the Patties, many of them New Yorkers, searching for solitude, serenity, and bargain property. Locals called them flatlanders during civil, if occasionally dismissive, conversations. Some natives called the outsiders much worse in private. The Patties first saw the cedar-shingled house next to a postcard-perfect pond in September 1999, and then spent 8 months struggling to get clear title and overcome a maddening series of obstacles to their purchase. It finally became theirs 2 months before the stranger came to the door. Locals knew the place as the Sugar House, and indeed, the home on Goose Green Road was a symbol of the changing community. It was built in 1993, replacing a landmark wooden shack where generations of Verscher residents had marked each spring by boiling maple sap into sugary syrup. During their first weeks in the house, Andrew and Diane tried to make it homey without Long Island-izing it. Their signature decorative touch was a mounted head of a 6-point buck Diane's father had shot years earlier, hung high on a living room wall next to the fireplace. The deer's limpid eyes stared down at anyone who entered the front door, above which a plaque read, "Home is where the heart is." Soon after they moved in, the Patties got a taste of life in a house built close to a country road. Twice, just weeks apart, two strangers came to the door late at night seeking help with broken-down cars. The first was a young man who tentatively tapped on the door, then stepped briskly, submissively backward when Andrew Patty answered. The stranger's solicitous air convinced Patty there was no danger, and in a display of new neighbor helpfulness, he hitched the stalled car to Diane's SUV and towed it to the man's home. The second uninvited guest was a young woman who politely asked to use the phone to call Ward's Garage, a half mile up the road. Again, Patty felt safe and obliged. The Patties didn't sense any hostility from their neighbors, but they wondered if some locals resented them. Andrew Patty thought his sparkling blue BMW with its New York plates gave some people the misimpression that he was a rich, liberal city boy who came north to smell flowers, hug trees, and call out, "Look, it's Bambi," at the sight of a deer. Several times during their first visits to their new home, the Patties noticed a silver Audi whizzing down Goose Green Road, its occupants yelling something hostile but unintelligible out the windows as they sped past. It happened often enough that Andrew took steps to avoid seeing the silver Audi. When he and Andy fished in their pond, they'd paddle their raft to its farthest reaches, an area hidden from the road by a stand of trees. On Monday, July 17, 2000, Diane went to work while Andrew and Andy packed the BMW for the 5-hour drive from Long Island to Verscher. They brought along their dog, a champagne-colored standard poodle puppy named Roxy. Their plan was simple. Spend a week of Andy's summer vacation together, father, son, and pup, fishing for bass and pickerel, hiking deep into the woods, and eating whatever struck their fancy. At night, they'd play cards and read books before the well-stoked fire. Sometimes they'd take target practice in the woods, but Andrew Patty wasn't a hunter. Years earlier, he'd come face-to-face with a deer in a stream and realized he couldn't imagine killing it. Still, he was a serious gun enthusiast who liked firearms the way he liked sharp cars. He respected their coiled power and enjoyed his ability to control and command them. The feel of a well-oiled gun at his side satisfied his own father's most frequent warning. Be careful. Strange things happen. Andrew had passed his love of guns to Andy. One of the boy's prized possessions was a dime with a small bullet hole he had placed dead center. Toward the end of their first full day in Vermont, Tuesday, July 18th, Andrew, Andy, and Roxy lost their way during a hike in the unfamiliar woods. As they hunted for the path home, the elder Patty checked his pockets for matches and began silently calculating how they could stay warm and safe until daybreak. By the time they found their way home, a light rain was falling, fish were jumping in the pond, and brown bats were swooping and soaring, feasting on mosquitoes in the darkening sky. Around 9 o'clock, tired but exhilarated, they called Diane to recount their adventure. Then they settled onto the couch for their nightly ritual of stories read aloud. At one point, Roxy heard something outside the house and let loose a rumbling bark. Patty was in no mood to walk her again, so he shushed her and returned to reading. But something was bothering him, too. He had the uncomfortable sense that someone was watching him through a window where the shade didn't fit quite right. He tried to shake it, but the feeling of eyes boring in on the back of his neck continued to gnaw at him. Patty pulled out his gun, and his son teased him. "You're going to shoot a hole through the window, Dad?" So he holstered it, sat back down, and continued reading. Then came the pounding on the door. Patty carefully considered the young man and his complaint of car problems. He decided this was no time to be neighborly. "No," Patty answered the stranger's request for help. "Do you have jumper cables?" the young man persisted. "No," Patty repeated. "Let me in. Can I use your phone?" "No." "Come on, let me use your phone." The stranger kept his face close to the window, his outsized nose almost pressed against the glass. Patty grew convinced that he and Andy were the targets of what New Yorkers call a push-in crime. A homeowner opens a door a crack, and the criminal forces his way inside to rob, rape, or kill. Patty looked over to his son, who was still curled up on the sofa. Roxy was nowhere in sight. She had responded to the tension by finding a place to hide. Though Patty sensed danger, it was even worse than he knew. Patty was unaware that the stranger had brought along two deadly weapons. One was an old but sharp hunting knife tucked in his military boot. The other was his best friend. While the stranger knocked on the door, the friend, also a teenager, a year younger than the young man at the door, crouched in a bush around the side of the house. He was dressed all in black, his face covered with a ski mask that revealed only his close-set eyes. The friend also had a hunting knife in his boot, and around his waist he wore a utility belt with pouches filled with duct tape, a jackknife, and plastic ties that could bind a person hand and foot. Nor did Patty know that before coming to his house, the two young men had spent hours digging a grave, 5 feet long and 3 feet deep, in the rocky soil next to an abandoned house up a nearby road. If their plan held true, that grave would soon be filled with earth and the lifeless bodies of Andrew and Andy Patty, and maybe their dog, too. "Andy, get over there," Patty said in a soft but firm voice, motioning his son toward a wall away from the front window, out of harm's way. When Andy was in place, Patty brought his gun out from behind his back. Still holding the blind with his left hand, he gave the stranger an eyeful of the Glock. "Whoa, whoa, whoa, whoa! I just want to use your phone," the stranger said. But he didn't seem scared by the sight of the gun. It only seemed to agitate him. "I'll tell you what I'll do," Patty said. "I'll call Ward's garage for you." "Okay, please do that. But please do that now." Patty let the blind drop and hustled over to a phone in the kitchen, not 20 feet from the door. Andy fell in step behind him, so close he was almost hugging his father from behind. Patty picked up the phone, the same phone he had used not 2 hours earlier to call Diane. Silence. Oh, shit. The phone's dead. Alarmed, he and Andy ran upstairs to try the phone in the master bedroom. Again, nothing. "What's going on, Dad?" "They've cut the wires," Patty told his son. He was on full alert, trying to keep Andy calm while assessing the situation. Patty surmised that when he refused to open the door, the stranger changed tactics and wanted him to discover that the phones were dead. Maybe then Patty would go outside to check the wires on the side of the house. Even with his gun, outside in the dark, Patty might be vulnerable. "If I check the phone lines," he thought, "they'll bushwhack me." No matter what happened, he'd stay inside. They ran back downstairs. Patty wanted to be there, Glock ready, if the stranger tried to bust through the door or the windows. Adrenaline pumping, half from fear and half from anger at the thought of someone hurting his son, Patty fought to keep a cool exterior to prevent Andy from panicking. They huddled on the living room floor, feeding the fire and waiting for a rock or a person to come crashing through the window. They had only seen one face at the door, but Patty remembered the queasy feeling of being watched. He was sure the young man at the door wasn't alone, and he wondered how many others might be out there. All he could do was hope that they had been spooked by the gun and wait. As minutes passed and nothing happened, Andy's fear began giving way to exhaustion. Patty lay his son down on the sofa, covered him with a blanket, and told him everything was fine. Soon Andy was asleep, but Patty wouldn't let down his guard. He spent the next few hours sitting on the hard floor, gun in hand, blinking to stay awake. He didn't dare sit on the couch or a chair, because the cushiony comfort might lull him to sleep. As the silence stretched into hours, fatigue crept up on him. Patty lay down on his back, his head toward the fireplace and his feet toward the door, so he could watch for intruders just by lifting his head. Patty spent the rest of the night that way, staring at the door, listening to night noises, hoping for daybreak, his gun on his chest, rising and falling with every breath. 2. Chelsea. In a sleepy hollow 5 miles or so from the Patty's rural retreat is Chelsea, Vermont. A soccer field sits alongside Main Street. Bordering the field to the north is a farm. To the west, a footbridge that crosses a stream, and beyond the stream, sloping hills smothered in trees. 3 bleachers near the road are, in fact, 3 large benches. Then there's the south end of the field, where a large soccer shooting board is located. The board only recently became a permanent fixture. The wall of wood is built from sheets of plywood, each 4 by 6 feet, nailed soundly together and then grounded firmly to withstand the hard shots of Chelsea kids. But there's something else about this new shooting board. One of the panels had a prior use that is of particular and peculiar interest. This single slab was originally a campaign sign in a 1999 student council election at the Chelsea Public School. Neatly hand-painted on a side hidden from public view, the sign reads, "Vote for Robert and Case, Student Council, 99. Robert was Robert Tulloch, candidate for student council president in the fall of his junior year. Basically, he wanted to run for school president to show everybody that he could be the school president, his best pal, Jim Parker, said later. Indeed, Jim helped Robert campaign and persuade other students to vote for a candidate originally considered a long shot. To guarantee that voters would take notice, Robert and his running mate, fellow junior Casey Case Purcell, positioned the large plywood sign right outside the school's main entrance. To further grab voters' attention, Robert decorated the sign with 4 fictitious blurbs. They rock, Rolling Stone. They have a style and fashion all to their own, Vogue. They're hell of a cool, Time. Their leadership skills are unparalleled, Newsweek. It was a sign replete with mistakes in spelling and grammar, displaying teen creativity and friendship. And it worked. Robert and Casey won, and their buddy Jim Parker was elected sophomore class representative. More than anything, the dual life of a piece of plywood, high-spirited campaign sign, and later permanently as soccer shooting board, captured the brio of youth and represented the very thing Chelseans proudly say their town is all about, kids and community. Down a few hundred yards from the soccer field is the town center, a tree-lined village featuring 2 town greens that Chelseans use for picnics, a farmer's market in the summer, an annual flea market, and high school graduation. During and after school, kids often hang out around the greens, throwing frisbees or skateboarding. Kids also gather in warm weather to shoot hoops at an asphalt court across the street. Main Street is a mix of old homes and small businesses, laundry flaps from clotheslines. Tractors pulling manure spreaders chug along during planting season. People actually wave to strangers. "Just yell north and I'll hear you," said one villager, directing a visitor from the North Common to her home up the street. The business sector amounts mostly to 1 of each, a bank, a bar named The Pines, a food market, a funeral home, a restaurant named Dixie Two's, an auto repair shop, a pizza shop, a coin laundry, a feed and grain store, and Will's store, with its wildly varied offerings. video rentals, newspapers, ice cream, beer, milk, worms and crawlers for fishing bait, and ammunition for turkey and woodchuck shooting. The town hall and library share a 19th-century red brick building located next to the North Common, and on the library shelves are the few books that tell the story of this quintessential New England town, including A History of Chelsea, Vermont, compiled by W. Sidney Gilman and a committee from the Chelsea Historical Society. Farming and family were the twin pillars upon which the community was founded in the 18th century. The original charter of 1781 explicitly says as much. Both were conditions for moving to the area. The charter required that settlers, most of whom were of English descent and came from Lower New Hampshire, Massachusetts, and Connecticut, shall plant and cultivate 5 acres of land and build a house at least 18 feet square on the floor, or have one family settled on each respective share or right of land in said township, with the term of 4 years. For the next 2 centuries, farming defined life in Chelsea, a community where changes always come as slowly as a soft breeze. In 1840, the population peaked at 1,959 residents. By the year 2000, it was about 700 fewer. Many of the outdoor activities and social traditions established throughout the 1800s are the same ones practiced 2 centuries later. The fishing, hunting, snowshoeing, skiing, and ice skating, along with the minstrel shows and tree plantings. It's the essence of country life found in just about any small New England town. One distinguishing characteristic of Chelsea is its long affinity for the dramatic arts. Sidney Gilman, the late local historian, noted, "A sense of drama has been inherent in Chelsea's history. Town Hall was itself once called the Opera House, and community drama clubs with names like the Chelsea Dramatic Company, or later the Chelsea Players, always seemed at work on one production or another." Not far from Chelsea are greater concentrations of upcountry wealth, to the west in Stowe, Vermont, for example, or to the south in Hanover, New Hampshire, home to Dartmouth College. For all its bucolic trappings, Chelsea is the seat of one of Vermont's most hardscrabble counties. Per capita income in Orange County in 1999 was $21,164, the 10th lowest of the state's 14 counties. Real estate still sells relatively cheap. 30 acres of Chelsea woodland was on the market in 2002 for $33,900. A 4-bedroom 1926 Dutch colonial on 10 acres of land near the village was listed at the reduced price of $159,900. The town does not have its own police department and pays about $4,500 to the county sheriff's office for law enforcement, mostly to handle accidents, speeding, and drunken driving. The core of the town has always been rock-ribbed conservative. In the 2000 presidential election, George W. Bush carried Chelsea with 350 votes to Al Gore's 272. Hanover, in contrast, went for Gore by a 3-to-1 margin, 3,391 votes to Bush's 1,541. Another reminder of Chelsea's conservative mindset was the big sign in block letters hanging from a house overlooking the North Common, "Take Back Vermont." The slogan used by those opposed to the state law recognizing the vows of same-sex couples. While many other Vermont villages have turned into ultra-quaint destinations for skiers and tourists, Chelsea has not. Fewer than 5 miles of the town's 70 miles of roads are paved. Instead, dirt and gravel roads zigzag through West Hill, where most Chelseans live, and some of those roads are impassable during the winter months and the mud season that follows. The town may cover 37 square miles, but 70% is thickly forested. In a way, Chelsea has always lived in a cocoon, a byproduct of geography and location. When the era of highway construction began in the 1950s, the region's 2 major routes, Interstates 91 and 89, came no closer than 25 miles to Chelsea. For the longest time, the world was out there. And starting in the late 1970s, photographers and writers began showing up to document Chelsea's rustic, lived-in feel and seemingly unchanged ways. As part of a New England Monthly article in 1985, more than half the town turned out to pose for a photographer in front of the white Greek Revival courthouse. 13 years earlier, in Vermont Life, a similarly themed story featured a photo album of Chelsea's farms, meadows, the village, and local kids playing soccer and basketball. Nearly identical photographs could be taken today. Both photo spreads featured the two town greens, North and South Common. In truth, the rectangular swatches of grass seem unremarkable to anyone familiar with the parks or large commons in cities like Boston or Montpelier, Vermont's capital. But context is everything, and what makes Chelsea's greens special is the fact that none of the neighboring communities have anything like them. Places like Verscher, Thetford, and West Fairley possess comparatively meager town centers with town offices, libraries, post offices, and homes built practically on the curb of a main road. There's no bona fide common area at which to dally, just a state road cutting into and out of town. Chelsea's two greens are therefore a rarity, a twin treasure, its own Boston Common, and a draw over the years for townsfolk from other towns. Years ago, the South Common was also the site of a whipping post and a set of stocks. The first county jail was built in 1796 on a site where today's brick jail sits, and the first courthouse atop South Common was built in the early 1800s. Crimes throughout the county are adjudicated in Chelsea. But then, as now, the criminal court docket has never been a crowded affair. Throughout the town's history, the crime log has featured the kind of petty offenses that occur anywhere: vandalism, thefts, and break-ins. Just as in any rural place suffering through long winters, Chelsea has also coped with crimes often hidden from public view, like domestic abuse. By the same token, just as in most of Vermont, there is nowhere near as much crime as cities see. The most notorious incident took place in the early 19th century involving Rebecca Peake, who was not actually from Chelsea but lived in Randolph, the next town to the west. In the summer of 1835, Peake was charged with poisoning her husband with arsenic. The murder case was that era's headline-grabbing, high-profile story. The court record described Peake's conduct this way: "Not having the fear of God before her eyes, but being moved and instigated by the devil and her malice aforethought, she killed her husband Ephraim on August 12, 1835. The December trial drew so many spectators that the proceedings were moved out of the courthouse and into the Congregational Church at North Common. Following Peake's conviction, gallows were built at South Common, and February 12, 1836 was set as the day Rebecca Peake would be hanged by the neck until she is dead. Despite a major snowstorm that Friday morning, curiosity seekers filled the South Common to watch a civics lesson in capital punishment. But the hanging never happened. Peake had stockpiled opium a local doctor had provided to help her sleep, and she slipped the hangman's noose by committing suicide. "Woman cheated gallows," read one newspaper headline. The gallows didn't stay there long. In Chelsea, it's simple. Murder is not part of the town's experience. Until recently, most wouldn't know if anyone from town had ever been charged with homicide. Few can place the name Rebecca Peake, and her case doesn't really count because she was from Randolph. Only the true old guard can come up with a lone case from local history. In 1978, a 34-year-old Chelsea man was charged with manslaughter after killing his brother with a shotgun blast to the chest at the house in West Hill the two men shared with their mother. Questions arose at trial about the shooter's mental health and his possible diminished capacity, and following deliberations, a Vermont jury came back with a not guilty verdict. It was a case that unfolded in the local news as a new couple was just settling into Chelsea. John Parker.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?